You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, January 27th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
This is episode 499.
Holy crap.
You know what that means?
Yes.
It means the next episode is 500. So we'll have a special episode next week for the 500th episode. George Robb is going to join us. And then on the day that the 500th episode goes up, on that Saturday, we're going to have an SGU house party with a bunch of guests. And on that day, we'll record the 501st episode. So maybe a couple surprises in store the next couple episodes. You'll have to check it out.
It'll be a celebration.
Yeah. Yeah, 500 is a round number, Evan.
There are two zeros on the end, last time I checked. Yeah,
well, people like zeros.
I'm not going to say it.
Say it.
500!
500! Yeah. And it's a good thing that we survived that near encounter with that asteroid. Imagine if we got wiped out right before our 500th episode.
Yeah, and who knew that that asteroid was coming? I mean, I only read about it really after the fact.
NASA,
and I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, thanks for telling me.
No, I was in the news.
Didn't exactly make the headlines.
Oh, there was one big surprise, though, wasn't there?
This asteroid had its own moon.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Isn't that cool? That is just so cool.
A little body orbiting around the asteroid.
We've talked about that before. I mean, there are other asteroids that have moons.
Oh, I just forgot.
But it is neat. So this is asteroid 2004 BL86, and it came to within 745,000 miles or 1.2 million kilometers, which is about 3.1 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. So it was well outside the orbit of the Moon. So it's a near-Earth asteroid, but that wasn't obviously anything super close or
but
risky.
It was big. I mean, that's a big boy. We won't have anything near that come close to us until, what was it, Apophis in 2028? I think. So that's that.
Yeah.
I mean, is that extinction level event size we're talking about? I mean, that's some major, major damage if that actually hit the Earth.
Yeah. So the main asteroid is 1,100 feet or 325 meters across, and the small moon is 230 feet or 70 meters, which ironically is the exact size of the Deep Space Network antenna that was used to view it.
Oh.
The antenna and the small moon are both 230 feet, 70 meters.
So do you think it's better if an asteroid hits the ocean or the land?
No, the ocean would be horrible. That's basically tsunamis,
everywhere.
Tidal waves in both directions, everywhere. Yeah, that would be
whereas land
horrible.
Would be what?
I mean, if it's big enough, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
You know, it's going to be horrible either way.
And if it has a moon accompanying it, it's worse. Because I imagine the moon crashes into us.
Yeah,
as well.
a little bit of an extra bonus.
You'd think though that that moon would get ripped off if it, you know, comes too close to a big planet or something. No.
Yeah, but it'll hit us. It may get ripped off by our gravity, but probably we just get sucked into us. I guess it doesn't
could
have
go into
to,
a stable orbit.
But
we'd have two moons.
We'll be dead, but yeah, we'll have two moons. All right. Well, Bob, you're going to tell us about the next forgotten superhero of science.
Yeah, so this week, guys, I'll be talking about Jocelyn Bell Burnell. She's an astrophysicist who was the first person to detect a pulsar. Have you ever heard of her?
Oh, yeah.
You have? Awesome.
That's one female scientist I never forget because she has the same first name as my wife, which is not a very common woman's first name.
Okay. So for those of you without a wife named Jocelyn, she might be brand new to you. She was born in 1943 in Northern Ireland.
Bob, my daughter's middle name is Bell, so that's why.
Okay,
I
so you too, then.
Is that right?
She graduated from Oxford with a PhD and started working on the study of quasars. She even helped to build a 4-acre radio telescope, which she spent two years on. And then the seminal moment happened in 1967. She noticed an anomaly. It was this weird persistent signal that repeated every 1.3 seconds, and she described it as a bit of scruff, but it was weird because it couldn't be coming from a quasar. So her PhD supervisor refused to believe that it was anything other than interference or caused by something man-made. He was very skeptical, but she spent a great deal of time going over literally miles of computer readouts over the days and weeks, and her persistent her persistence paid off. As good scientists, they crossed off the list of mundane possibilities like satellites and TV signals. And they even, she even...
Washing machines.
Even those. She briefly named it LGM for Little Green Men because it was conceivable that it was an alien signal. But eventually they realized that what they had found was a very special class of neutron star, one that rotates while emitting a collimated beam of radiation like radio waves. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now, Antony Hewish, her PhD supervisor, eventually won the Nobel Prize along with Martin Ryle for their work on the discovery. And as you may be, realizing right now, Belle Brunelle did not get it. Many important astronomers were livid that she was not included, especially physicist Fred Hoyle, who told the reporter, yes, Jocelyn Bell was the actual discoverer, not Hewish, who was her supervisor, so she should have been included. He even claimed at one point that Hewish stole some of her data, but I'm not sure if that's actually been totally corroborated. So now, granted, I should say that the demarcation between a supervisor and a student regarding discoveries is often a murky one and hard to tease out who did what and who should get credit for what. And throughout all of this, Belle Brunelle has acted with absolute class, accepting the outcome with grace and no hard feelings.
I'd have hard feelings.
So my question is, why isn't she a household name? She pretty much was the first to discover a pulsar. But guys, read up on Jocelyn Belle Brunelle and her amazing contributions. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing plasma electrodynamics in rotating degenerate matter. More people should know what she did.
Cool.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Let's get to some news items. Jay, you're going to start us off with the green coffee bean hoax.
I heard about that on Dr. Oz. Yeah.
Sure you did. This is good news. Although I wish
good news, everyone.
I wish it didn't take this long for the law to catch up with the rampant frauds and scams that are all over the Dr. Oz show and a bunch of other TV shows. So, guys, have you heard of the green coffee bean supplement
The
latest in diet pills?
Oh, Dr. Oz swears by it.
It's a miracle, Jay. A miracle.
So if you lose weight fast, no exercise needed.
Not just weight. We're talking 20 pounds of weight loss, 16% body fat in 12 weeks with no exercise. Yep.
If you guys watch the Dr. Oz infomercial, the Dr. Oz show, then you would know all about this particular supplement because Oz seems to love it. The good news is the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission here in the U.S., has also heard about it, and they're taking strong actions against these companies. Now, here are the companies. Genesis Today, Pure Health, and the guy that owns them or is a high up on the food chain, Lindsay Duncan. Now, Lindsay Duncan, you guys hear about him?
Mm-hmm. It's a guy?
I never heard of him. Yeah, I never heard of Lindsay Duncan before. He is he is many things, but first and foremost, he's an incredible scam artist. He's been on hundreds of TV shows, like selling all these and a ton of other crap that his companies sell. So they're in big trouble. In particular, he is in big trouble for deceptively claiming that there are weight loss benefits in taking the green coffee bean supplement.
Does he live in Little China?
This has been through a marketing campaign, including several appearances on the Dr. Oz show, The View, and like I said, tons of other shows, lots of news stations. I found him on YouTube, and he's all over YouTube. And there are people that have made videos of him on all of his appearances, and you would be amazed at how many shows this guy has been on. And he does the same bit pretty much every time.
He sounds parasitic to me.
His companies have been barred from making deceptive claims about the health benefits or efficacy of any dietary supplement or drug product because of this lawsuit. Now, according to the report, they also have to pay out $9 million back to consumers after making the deceptive and unsubstantiated claims about weight loss products. Now, here's the rub. Green coffee bean supplements contain a substance called chlorogenic acid, and this is claimed to be the active ingredient that causes weight loss. Now, there must be something special about the green coffee beans, right? You'd think, why they pick green coffee? Somebody came up with green coffee beans. Why? No, they're just unroasted coffee beans. When you roast a coffee bean, it destroys most of the caffeine and most of the chlorogenic acid. Now, this is why a dark roast coffee, now Steve, I know you don't know this, but people that drink coffee may or may not know this, but like a darker roast coffee actually has less caffeine than light roast because it's not being cooked as long. And that heat destroys a lot of the chemicals that are in the coffee bean.
Oh.
So while on the Dr. Oz show, Duncan made incredible claims about how effective the pills are. Like you can lose up to 17 pounds, like Bob said, 16% body fat over a 12-week period without exercise. And he said, and most importantly, that all of this was backed by clinical study. Now, his claims were that chlorogenic acid stops sugar from being absorbed by the body. That's ridiculous. On The View, he said the product was great for diabetics.
Oh, wow.
And it's completely wrong. Yeah. I mean, seriously, he's telling people that have diabetes, you know, this is a product you should take because it'll lower your blood sugar. And what's worse is that he came to the show specifically to market his bogus products. And when they traced back the things that he was doing before he started making these huge appearances, like they saw him ramping up to get ready for the
Oz effect,
this big medium.
For the Oz effect.
Yeah. Unfortunately, if you go on Walmart and Amazon right now, you can find, I'm not sure if his products are still available, but there's a ton of green coffee bean products on both of those websites that, you know, that crap is out there. Now, a couple more quickies. Are you guys aware of the study done by the British Medical Journal where they randomly selected 40 episodes of the Dr. Oz show and another show called The Doctors, right? They found that about 50% of the health recommendations made on either of the shows contradicted what the latest science says.
Yeah, but take that a little bit further, on the Dr. Oz show, they found that only 33% of the specific recommendations that he makes were backed by believable or somewhat believable evidence. And even that was an incredibly low bar, because if there was a single case report that they considered that backed by evidence, most of the recommendations he was making were not backed by, you know, what I would consider credible evidence. Even with the low bar, a third, you know, two thirds had nothing. Nothing. I mean, that's ridiculous.
The cool thing is, to summarize, you know, the FTC got involved somehow. I couldn't find anything on how they got involved. Like, did they run their own investigation or whatever? But I have to say, though, skeptical activism is important for things like this, because a lot of the facts that are out on the web are being generated by skeptics and are being, you know, being distributed by skeptics. And I guarantee you that had an effect on this. So I encourage you, you know, even if you don't have the time or energy to do a weekly podcast or write a blog or whatever, I mean, every once in a while, like, you know, maybe pick, like, as an example, Dr. Oz, and do some research and post it somewhere and give, you know, let the skeptical community benefit from that information. But you never know. You could be influencing, you know, local government or federal government to make changes and pass laws and arrest people and, you know, lay down some freaking science, man.
You can file reports to the FTC, and, you know, and every country has an organization, government agency usually, that you can report if you think that a company is making unsubstantiated health claims, and then they'll research it. The problem with the FTC is that they're overwhelmed. I mean, they're playing whack-a-mole. They have to pick and choose, you know, their targets. There's no way can they keep up with all of the nonsense that's going on out there.
I don't know if this is necessarily going to dissuade other people from necessarily going forward with some similar claims like this about this product. They're going to work, you know, they'll work between the margins and the legal minutia and so forth to make sure that they only say enough that can get them what they want without getting into legal trouble. So yes, I'm happy about this, but at the same time, really a lot of damage has been done.
They'll just go on to the next thing.
Yeah.
All right. Evan, what are you doing after the show?
I'm going to Disneyland.
Thank you. You took my cue very nicely. Be careful, though. Have you gotten all your vaccines?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Who knows? We'll find out, won't we? latest news out of California regarding the measles, unfortunately. It's not good. Not good. And as you know, there's an outbreak of the measles that has occurred in California. The latest statistics are there are 87 confirmed cases. That's as of today. Who knows if that number will tick up slightly, maybe by the time the episode goes up. But of the 87 cases, 50 of them can be linked directly to Disneyland, which was once the happiest place on earth. But I think that's an extraordinary claim now. We know about the vaccination status of 42 people. Of these 87 cases. The rest is it's unclear. Of the 42 people whose status we know, whether they were vaccinated or not, 34 of the people who contracted the measles were unvaccinated, 3 were partially vaccinated, and 5 were fully vaccinated. So what does that tell you? You were much more susceptible to catch these measles at Disneyland if you were unvaccinated, as opposed to the small percentage of people who were vaccinated and happened to contract it.
Yeah, I did a quick calculation, assuming that 90% of the population is vaccinated. Those are the latest rates. Assuming that number holds in Disneyland, then that means if you're unvaccinated, you were 67 times more likely to become infected with measles than if you were vaccinated.
Wow.
Yeah, it's more evidence that shows you that vaccinations matter.
Oh, yeah.
It's so important. This disease of measles, this virus, was eliminated back in 2000, so just 15 years ago.
Well, to be clear, endemic measles was – like smallpox has been completely eradicated. It doesn't exist anywhere in the world in the wild. Measles was – it was no longer endemic in the United States, which means that there wasn't measles – bouncing around in the U.S., all of the cases were imported from outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. But now it's basically coming back as an endemic illness, as sort of a self-perpetuating illness.
Yeah, and those international travelers that had measles and came to the States because of herd immunity, it never penetrated very deeply because specifically of herd immunity.
There'd be a few cases, but maybe with close contacts, but it wouldn't lead to an outbreak. Yeah, now we're getting outbreaks because herd immunity has been eroded by pockets of vaccine refusers, essentially.
But Steve, do they know where this particular strain came from, or like can they follow it back in any way?
They haven't found the original case that caused the Disneyland outbreak.
Okay. Patient zero.
Yeah, they haven't found patient zero. Yeah.
Steve, I've heard from many places that measles is not something to be all up in arms about. It's one of those things, a chickenpox maybe kind of thing where, yeah, you know, kids get it or you get it at some point. You just kind of suffer through the symptoms and you go along your way once it's over.
Yeah, that's not true. This is a serious illness. I mean, you're basically miserable for 2 weeks. It causes high fever and uncomfortable rash. Of the people in this outbreak, 25%, 1 in 4, have to be hospitalized.
Oh, wow.
And any illness that puts you in the hospital is a big deal, you know?
Yeah, it's not trivial.
Yeah, this is not a trivial illness, but the anti-vaxxers would want you to think that this is no big deal because they're always trying to minimize the benefits of vaccines and exaggerate their risks. That's what they do.
Guys, did you know that in Orange County, where Disneyland is, that there are schools in that county where as many as 60 to 80% of the students have missed at least some of their vaccinations? 60 to 80% for some of these schools—that is just a mind-boggling number.
What the hell is going on with these states? I mean, like
that could be a little deceptive because these schools specifically are vaccine refuser friendly, so they congregate there. You know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there's a good reason for them to be that high, but still the fact remains is those numbers are huge.
Yeah.
And one other quick thing, you might think, oh, well, Disney ought to do something about it, but there's actually nothing that Disney could have done or can do in the future to prevent an outbreak like this. The bottom line is that the virus particles are airborne, and when you have people congregating together, stuff like this is going to happen. So it's not like you can actually institute anything that could, you know, help this.
Well, they're being reactive to it, at least properly. Disneyland has said that all employees who could have been in contact with people diagnosed with the measles were asked to provide vaccination records or do a blood test that showed they had the immunity to the disease. And if the employees had not been vaccinated or couldn't confirm it, they were asked to go on to paid leave until their status could be confirmed or the 21 days are up. 21 days is the time
period.
In which you can, give it to other people.
But I hear Disney's opening up a new ride. It's a smallpox world.
After all.
Oh, man, nice one.
Can you imagine people on the teacup ride and they're just sort of throwing bodily fluids all around?
Yeah.
They've actually tracked some other folks who had visited Disneyland and had come down with the measles in other states. And yeah, they were able to corroborate that these people had visited Disneyland in the last month or two. And it's not isolated to just California. It's getting around.
There was an Onion article that completely nailed it the headline is, "I don't vaccinate my child because it's my right to decide what eliminated diseases come roaring back."
Yeah, I saw that.
Beautiful. That's constitutionally protected. Yeah,
the money quote is, "The decision to cause a full-blown multi-state pandemic of a virus that was effectively eliminated from the national population generations ago is my choice alone. And regardless of your personal convictions, that right should never be taken away from a child's parent. Never."
Oh, man, that's beautiful.
Satire is wonderful. All right, we're going to change gears a little bit. Bob, I understand that our entire galaxy is a wormhole. Yes. And I can use this wormhole to travel to other universes, maybe.
Well, close. You're very, very close, Steve.
I made up the last bit, but the wormhole thing I read.
Yes, yes. And yes, the astrophysicists are claiming that some of them anyway, that the Milky Way may indeed contain what they're calling a galactic transport system, which consists of a galaxy-sized wormhole that is traversable and could potentially bring you to other such wormholes in other galaxies. So my first thought was like, oh, this is bullshit, right? Well, I read about this, and I have to admit, yes, it's probably bullshit. So, all right, what's the evidence? What evidence could they have for something just so incredibly awesome and crazy? Well,
outlandish.
So it's a team of astrophysicists, U.S., from the United States, India, and Italy. They came up with this idea after combining the distribution and density of dark matter in our galaxy with general relativity and the assumption that wormholes or Einstein-Rosen bridges actually do exist in our universe. And astrophysicist Salucci describes their results like this. He said, "What we get is that our galaxy could really contain one of these tunnels, and the tunnel could even be the size of the galaxy itself. But there's more. We could even travel through this tunnel based on our calculations. It could be navigable, just like the one we've seen in the recent film Interstellar." Of course, they had to bring in Interstellar, but and that's one hell of a claim.
Of course,
yeah.
I mean, Interstellar may have been even more scientific than we thought. The real support system, though, for this wormhole that they claim it's really all about the dark matter. That's one of the key things, as I see it. He continues here: "In the galactic halo region, dark matter may supply the fuel for constructing and sustaining a wormhole. Hence, wormholes can be found in nature, and our study may encourage scientists to seek out evidence for this." Well, I've read a lot of different wormhole theories. Steve, I'm sure you've probably come across a bunch in the past as well, but none of them are quite like this. But in fact, wormholes in general have not been scientifically ruled out. I mean, Einstein's general relativity does have valid solutions to it that do include wormholes. So it certainly seems at least possible for them to exist. So they're not just completely fanciful and not based on anything. But we still don't know much about them at all. Scientists have lots of mutually exclusive ideas about them. On one hand, they may be unimaginably small, like 10 to the minus 33 centimeters or something like that. But on the other hand, they could become...
you could never get a ship in there.
Yeah, right. But on the other hand, Jay, they could become macroscopic. if it's a primordial wormhole and with the universe's expansion, they could get bigger, perhaps. On one hand, they may be big enough for us to send signals or objects through, but on the other hand, they might just spontaneously collapse right after the journey starts for no apparent reason.
Like that Star Trek episode where they auctioned off the wormhole, right? And the other end was unstable and the Ferengis got caught.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that. Also, scientists, some say that they may be held open indefinitely if you use something like exotic or negative matter. But on the other hand, the presence of normal matter near the mouth of the wormhole could just slam it shut. And finally, another interesting difference I came up with is that they may even be useful for time travel, unless, of course, Hawking's chronology protection conjecture prevents that from happening. So they're kind of all over the place. You know, different papers saying different things, other papers having exceptions for the other papers. So they're all over the place.
But that's science. I mean, that's all the different scientists, you know, putting up their best ideas. I mean, that's what makes it happen.
I totally agree.
Is any of this testable on any level?
They have some ideas to test this by looking at gravity lensing or to examine nearby spiral galaxies really closely. But they say that they can't really do that yet. We don't have the technology yet. So this latest iteration of wormholiness, they claim that it's not just large and stable, but large enough to be comparable to the size of the Milky Way itself. I mean, it's not like all over the entire galaxy in their theory. It's really centered above and below the core of the galaxy. So it's huge, but it's still pretty far away. And specifically, I think they're saying that the mouth is in the halo of the galaxy. So the other big difference is that the claim that it does not need to be held up by exotic matter, which is typically what you read about holding a wormhole open for people to go in, is that you need to create or have some naturally occurring exotic or negative matter that can hold it open. They're saying that dark matter itself does that. So that's a big difference. I was glad, though, that Salucci did kind of reel himself back in a little bit. He said that we're not claiming that our galaxy is definitely a wormhole, but simply that, according to theoretical models, this hypothesis is a possibility. So, I mean, you can't argue with that. I mean, his theoretical model says it's possible, and that's what he's saying. So, okay, that's fine. But I still think it's an exceedingly unlikely to be true. You know, there's really no observational evidence at all. And that's okay at this stage of inquiry. That's okay. You don't need evidence yet. I mean, they're just, you know, doing some math. But don't you guys think that at some point this would have been detected? It's something so big and so incredible. I mean, you think we would have gotten a hint of it, in the near the center of our galaxy. But I'll end it with Lawrence Krauss quote. He agrees that we should definitely not get our hopes up. He said, "My understanding of wormholes is that we have no idea how to make them stable and traversable without exotic unknown forms of energy. So any discussion of traversable wormholes as realistic travel devices is highly speculative at best." And so there you have it. Basically, don't get your hopes up. But who would want to travel all that way anyway, right? I mean, even if it were there, right, you'd never get there. You'd have to travel tens of thousands of light years.
I've pretty much resigned myself to the fact that interstellar travel is never going to be easy. You know what I mean? I just don't think that we're going to be subspacing our way around the universe.
Well, easy is one thing. I mean, if it's achievable, I would love for it to be achievable, and I'm all about it being hard work. Sure, why not? Most science is incredibly hard work.
Yeah,
what an achievement it will be if we.
I mean,
it
just may never be possible to travel interstellar distances in any time frame other than like tens of thousands of years. You know what I mean? Which may be a good thing when you think about it. If alien civilizations are out there and they could be zipping around with faster than light drive or subspace drive or whatever, that may not be the best thing for us.
But the cool thing though, Steve, there's a really cool part to that though. I agree. I think it's probably impossible. But the really cool thing is that if you really, really, really wanted to do it, you still can. You just have to not care about how much time passes on your planet. If you don't care, then you could traverse the known universe in decades. Just use time dilation to your benefit. And if you don't care that the sun will, you know, be a white dwarf when you get back, then if you don't care about that, you're golden. And that's what I would love to do.
Well, I do care about that.
You'd want to you'd want to come back at that point? Wow. Okay.
All right, guys. Well, let's go from the really big to the really small. We're going to talk about bacteria. Simple. This is very interesting. Scientists at Harvard and Yale are working out a way to fail-safe artificial bacteria. So we've been talking about genetically modified bacteria and how it's getting closer and closer to like fully artificial life. But even now, there already are genetically modified bacteria that are doing work. You know, if you take insulin for your diabetes, that insulin probably comes from genetically modified bacteria, where the gene to make insulin was inserted into the bacteria and they're cranking it out in vats, you know. You could also genetically engineer bacteria to, like, eat up spilled toxins or petroleum products or even make synthetic fuel. So these little buggers could be quite useful. However, there is a concern about releasing artificial bacteria into the environment that may have unintended consequences. So at present, we use physical containment strategies, essentially just keeping the bacteria physically isolated so there's no possibility that we'll get out there into the wild. Well, researchers at Harvard and Yale have been working on a new strategy to contain artificial bacteria, which actually could be applied to not just bacteria, but to really any life form. And this one is very similar to what was discussed in the movie Jurassic Park. If you remember in Jurassic Park, there was the lysine contingency. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm. They engineered the dinosaurs so that they couldn't make the amino acid lysine. So it had to be fed to them. So if they ever escaped, they would, you know, go into a coma in a day and then die because they weren't being fed a regular diet of this missing amino acid.
But nature finds a way.
Of course, life found a way in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Nature finds a way. Always. Well,
in the movies.
I don't know about. I don't know if nature's going to find a way around this one. The researchers actually did something more extreme. They did a very similar thing where they engineered the bacteria so that they have to be fed an amino acid they can't obtain for themselves. But here's the twist. They are dependent on an amino acid that doesn't exist in nature.
Oh, my yeah, God. That's brilliant.
That's inspired. I
very
love
good.
It.
Very good. That-
what they did was, so you guys know about the trinucleotide code. So, yeah, so DNA has four nucleic acids. Remember, cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine. So that's the four-letter code. Each amino acid or each three-letter combination is a code. And so, therefore, that's 4 to the 3rd power, which is 64 different possibilities. There are 20 different amino acids that make up life. So there's a little bit of redundancy built in there. But also, some of the codons, some of the three-letter codes, code for things like stop making the protein here, the so-called stop codons. So what the researchers did was they took one of the stop codons and they reprogrammed it so that it coded for an artificial amino acid that doesn't exist in nature. And this, they changed the code so that this amino acid would be incorporated into critical proteins. Therefore, unless the bacteria were being fed this artificial amino acid, they couldn't make their proteins and they couldn't reproduce. That's a pretty significant change. I'm not sure if the bacteria will be able to spontaneously go back. So this is like a double failsafe. You know, did the Jurassic Park one better? The researchers also say that their plan is to incorporate like 5, 6, 7 different types of recoding into the artificial bacteria so that it becomes less and less likely that some mutation or whatever, that something could happen that would, the bacteria could work their way around this failsafe. So they could easily build a dozen failsafes into an artificial life form. So there's absolutely no way that it's going to be able to evolve around the need, you know, to be fed, for example, artificial food in the laboratory or in their work conditions. So that's a pretty good failsafe. I mean, I think that's, you never say never, obviously, right? I mean, we always have to anticipate things, but that looks pretty reassuring, yeah. You know?
What are we going to do with this artificial bacteria?
All sorts of different stuff. I mean, think about it. You know, the big one that a lot of people know about is that it could eat oil that was spilled in the ocean, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, bacteria could generate hydrogen. We can make them do whatever we want them to do.
Create insulin, all yeah. sorts of different chemicals that we would find incredibly helpful. I think this is a great idea. I like how they call them GROs, genetically recoded organisms. And yeah. somebody, I was reading somewhere, somebody was making an analogy to them as domesticating a wild creature, which is, I think, is fairly apt. Steve, question for you, though.
Mm-hmm.
If they do get out into the wild, I know they wouldn't live very long, but could they take advantage of what little time they have in the wild to, use a plasmid and transfer some key genes before they died?
Yeah, but if their genes are using a different code, it doesn't matter.
So
that's the whole point.
So they couldn't.
Their genes literally use a different genetic code than the rest of life on Earth. Not only that, but that also makes them resistant to viruses that attack bacteria.
Yeah, that's cool. But Steve, I mean, it's not every gene though. I mean, they still might be able to transfer other important genes that have not been recoded. It's not every gene.
Yeah, well, it depends on the extent of the recoding.
Okay. And also yeah. they say that it was a huge effort to re-engineer this genome. I'm thinking, all right, what kind of effort is it going to take to re-engineer other genomes? Is it, I assume they've learned a lot and they could do it quicker, but it sounds like that it would be a huge effort every time they grab a new organism and try to re-engineer it. Or maybe they could have these templates that they can then just plug into these other genomes and not be such a huge effort.
Yeah. I mean, I would be surprised if it just didn't get easier with
yeah.
time, right? I mean, think about, when, for example, mapping the genome, I mean, it's sped up by orders of magnitude just during the genome project. So, you know, I can imagine 10, 20 years, 30 years, you know, we may be able to just do this as simple as printing something. Who knows? I doubt it's going to stay as difficult as this first one was.
You know?
But, and even if it is, if it is a huge project and it takes time, that's not that big a deal, you know, because, once you make the bacteria, you got it, you know, then.
Yeah.
Once you self-perpetuating. Right. But imagine like having life forms, even like vertebrate life forms that have a completely different genetic code and biochemistry that, you know, totally incompatible with other life on Earth.
I can't wait.
It can't do anything other than the specific task that we give it.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it, man.
Can't wait to see what comes of this.
All right, Jay, let's move on to Who's That Noisy?
Okay, so last week I played you this noisy.
I feel the liftoff. The clock has started. Roger.
Who was that and what was that? Any guesses, guys?
Was that Christopher Columbus sailing to discover the New World?
Did he direct the Harry Potter movie?
That was astronaut Scott Carpenter, and that was the launch of the Mercury Atlas Aurora 7 on May 24th, 1962.
Cool.
62.
Yeah, so as I was listening to a lot of sound files that NASA put out, yeah, I know, I realized I didn't know much about that particular launch. I thought it was cool, and I started listening to stuff, and there you go. So this week, I have something interesting for you guys. So I want our listeners to listen to this noisy, and if you get any kind of head sensation, a headache, a buzzing in your head, or anything from listening to this noise, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. In this subject, put, "Who's that noisy? Strange sound." And here is the noisy.
All right, Jay, that sounds pretty cool.
Cool. All right.
All right, we're going to do one question this week. This question comes from David from Arizona, and David writes, "I got into a discussion with the absurdity of atheism on Facebook regarding the similarity of human and chimp DNA. It was exhausting and ultimately non-productive. Unless someone on the fence was moved by my argument, one can hope. I'd like to know if there are resources available to help argue various points of contention with a theist. There are resources online to help the theists. The argument, he cited what looked like a legit paper that stated 66 to 93% of DNA was the same and that chimp and humans had a common ancestor. From that moment on, he used the number 70%. Would not acknowledge up to 93%, said the common ancestor part of the paper was opinion, and that 3 million years was not enough time to explain the 30% divergence given current rates of mutation. Now I am a science enthusiast. I don't know anything about the moderator, and I feel I was not adept enough to defend my position. I found three papers from the same site that stated 93% and up to 95% similarity. One of the papers used only 800 kilobytes of genome information, which was all the information available at that time. It was difficult to defend my position." This is a really interesting question. Essentially, the point here is that if you make a comparison between human and chimpanzee DNA, then you can make some kind of statement about how similar and how different they are. You guys have probably heard the figure that human and chimp DNA are 98% similar. That figure has actually been revised to 96%. So that's really the currently accepted figure.
Therefore, God.
So what is David talking about? What's this paper that shows we're only 70% similar? Well, that's a paper by Jeffrey Tompkins, who is a creationist, and he published his paper in the Creation Research Journal. So it's actually utter nonsense. But it's what I call sophisticated nonsense. It's specifically designed to be so technical that unless you're an expert or can read and understand arguments or information written by experts, you know, you're going to have a hard time in a Facebook discussion countering this apparently peer-reviewed published journal. So here's the trick. Here is how Tompkins is fooling people up with the 70% figure. So first of all, you need to realize that there is absolutely no one correct or objective way to come up with a single percent figure that tells you how similar the DNA is of two different species.
Okay.
Right? So any figure is ultimately arbitrary. For example, how are you comparing the two strands of DNA? Are you just laying two strands naked side by side and then just counting the similarity? Yeah, base pairs. If that were the case, then a single one insertion in one strand of DNA over the other will put them out of alignment, right? And then they'll essentially be utterly scrambled with respect to each other. So obviously that's a meaningless way to compare two strands of DNA. So, okay, so you have to line up the DNA so that the same genes are next to the same genes. And you're saying, well, how many mutations differ between those genes? But then what about gene duplication? What about when there's extra genes in one that's not in the other? What if there are other insertions? What if there are chromosomal changes? You know, like in humans, two chimpanzee chromosomes fuse together to form one human chromosome. So how do you count that as a percent difference? You know, there's just no way to put a number on it. So the method that is used depends on the question you're asking. In this particular case, the question that Tompkins is applying the analysis to is how evolutionarily close are humans and chimpanzees? If that's your question, then what you want to do is line up the same genes. Genes where you could say, okay, here's a gene in a human and here's the analogous gene in a chimpanzee. And then you count point mutation differences. The reason why you do it that way is because then you can use the mutation rate, the background mutation rate to count how many mutation differences there are between the two species. You compare that to the mutation rate, and then that gives you an estimate of how evolutionarily distant they are, you know? So if you have X mutations every million years, you have, you know, five X mutations, they're 5 million years apart, right? That's the basic math. So if you're doing that type of analysis, you have to line up the genes. And that type of analysis is what gives you the 96% figure, which admittedly is the highest figure, but it's the only one that matters. It's the only one that matters when you're asking how close are they in evolutionary history. When you do that, guess what? When you compare the mutation rates, you find out that humans and chimps are separated in terms of the number of mutations different between them. They're separated by something like 8 to 13 million years, which is close enough to the fossil evidence to be in the right ballpark, right? Especially keeping in mind that, as we've talked about before on the show, the split between two species is never absolutely clean. You know, there's some back breeding over time, and, you know, the populations could be isolated and then together and then isolated. You know, it's not like there's always one clean division point. And humans and chimps had a very unclean, spread out sort of separation over time. But anyway.
Yeah, because the divergence is estimated to be between what, 8 and 12 million years, or 8, 13, or 8 and 9, something like that. There's like a few million years. There's a range, and that explains that range. Is that, can't just say it was on this date.
So Tompkins is not using the correct method of comparison. He is comparing chromosomes to see how many segments line up to some arbitrary degree, and then is saying only 70% of them line up, which is it's an arbitrary figure in any case. But even it also, other people have said they've had trouble reproducing his results. But even if we give him every benefit of the doubt and say that his 70% figure is accurate given the methods that he used, who cares? It's completely irrelevant. And he makes a gross scientific error in using the 70% figure and then saying there hasn't been enough time evolutionarily to explain the 30% difference. Because you're using a time frame of point mutations and comparing that to chromosomal mutations. So like, for example, you could have a gene duplication where you duplicate a gene with 10,000 base pairs. So now that's 10,000 base pairs difference between humans and chimps. But that didn't happen through 10,000 point mutations. It happened through one gene duplication mutation. It was a single event. It wasn't 10,000 mutation events. Does that make sense? It's the completely wrong kind of analysis.
The question is, does he know that?
Yeah, that's a good question. But it got published in a quote unquote peer reviewed journal, but it's really a creationist rag, which, you know, tells you it's just worthless. But, you know, it obviously was just ignored by the scientific community because his analysis is completely nonsensical. But it served its purpose. It's now fodder for creationists on Facebook to confuse non-experts with this technical mumbo jumbo. Sophisticated nonsense. That's the purpose of it.
Very insidious.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Yeah. And it took me some time to like really deconstruct that argument and find out the technical details of exactly why it was wrong. I mean, I knew that it was wrong broad brushstrokes, but I mean, you know, I was already a lot of the way there, and still it took me some time, and I already kind of know how to search for things like that. So the other part of David's question is, where do you go for research? Because, you know, that one specific question, you really just have to know how to use Google. And I can't really tell you, like, there's this one place you can get all the answers. TalkOrigins.org is a good first place to go. If you go to TalkOrigins, and then you could use their search engine on their site, and they have a lot of essays. But they may not have addressed this one very specific technical issue. If you can't find it there, then you just have to know how to search for it on Google to try to find, and then you may have to look through, don't just look at the first page. You may need to go to 30 or 40 results before you find one that's really addressing the issue. Oftentimes, the first article I find gives me just enough information to do a better search. So anyway, that takes, I get it. That takes time. You know, you're not going to do that in the comment section of a Facebook page.
Mm.
This is one of the things that fascinates and infuriates me about things like creationism. You know, where they're just doing science wrong, profoundly and demonstrably wrong. And like, you never quite know how aware of that they are.
Yeah, because as we are well aware, self-deception can be incredibly powerful.
Yeah, motivated reasoning is powerful.
Yes, it's very hard to determine where they're at exactly in their heads.
Yeah. Well, let's go on with a name that logical fallacy. You haven't had one of these in a while. This one comes from Chase in Japan, who writes, "Hello, I run a YouTube channel that is completely unrelated to anything skeptical and is mainly just about living in Japan as an international couple with a baby. However, recently in a video blog, I was commenting on a silly television show here in Japan that had a segment that day with supposed UFO expert. It was the usual stuff you see in the media, nothing special. However, I got a random comment in the YouTube video that was full of the usual UFO believer arguments, and I felt was full of logical fallacies. And so I thought I'd ask how many logical fallacies are in this comment." Okay, you guys ready for the comment?
Yep, do it.
Yes.
Here we go. "Yes, a percentage of UFO videos and pictures are faked or photoshopped, but dude, really? There are thousands of videos and photos and more of them in daylight and close up. Just the law of averages with thousands of them means that there are real craft. They do perform things that cannot be done with any current public technology and cannot be done with any materials we have with our present understanding of physics. A human body would not survive the maneuvers performed. Just go to the Disclosure Project website and read the affidavits from hundreds of upper U.S. and global military and scientists working on government black ops projects. You need to catch up." I agree. That is boilerplate UFO conspiracy nonsense. But what do you think about that? In this segment, it's called Named Out Logical Fallacy, but the errors in thinking that people make are not always, you know, specifically logical fallacies. There could be other types of errors as well. But what do you guys think?
I found four. The comment about the law of averages, thousands of them mean that there are real crap. That's just the argument, argumentum ad populum. That's right. That's just like there's so many of them that some of them have to be real. Is that kind of a variant of ad populum?
No. So I think you're trying to force it into a logical fallacy, but it's not, you know, the argument ad populi is that, well, lots of people think this, therefore it must be true. This is more of a false premise. The premise is that they all can't be lying or mistaken. So there's the hidden premise here is that there's thousands of them. Okay, so how many could be fake, right?
Right.
So you're saying that obviously not to thousands of them, they can't all be fake.
That's the key.
They can't all be fake. Why can't they all be fake?
Every last one.
Yeah, every last one. Can 100 of them be fake? Can 500 of them be fake? Can 900? If 900 of them can be fake, why can't 1,000? So there's this the false premise here is this notion that, you know, you got this sort of law of averages. It's almost as if there's so many independent incidences that some of them have to be real.
Is it an abuse of the law of large numbers?
Well, it's almost as if every one of them has a chance to be real.
Right,
and
yes.
Even if that chance is small, there's so many of them that by chance alone, yeah, some of them have to be real. Well, but no, there doesn't have to be a chance that any of them are real.
Right.
You have to look at – he's looking at it backwards. You have to look at it from the point of view of there are phenomena out there that people misinterpret as unidentified flying objects, that they interpret as being alien spacecraft. There's no arbitrary limit on how big that phenomenon can be. It is absolutely possible that we live in a world where we are not being visited by aliens. In such a world, some people would misinterpret mundane encounters, objects, whatever, phenomena as UFOs. And there could be thousands of them. So what? I mean, there could be millions of them. There are millions of them. So yeah, I think that the bad premise there is that, you know, the more there are, just by chance alone, some have to be real, as if like you're rolling the dice each time and there's a chance that they could be real, but that's just not valid premise.
Is there a specific fallacy then that you would tie to that comment, or is it just a false premise?
I think it's just a false premise.
Okay.
It's an unstated major premise that is false.
All right. Then I think that same one would somewhat apply to the next one where he's saying that they're doing things that they cannot be done with current public technology. I also thought that was kind of a half-truth, suppressed evidence kind of fallacy, you know, because the assumption is that it's actually doing those things, which could be wrong.
Yeah, it's begging the question, right? So it's a form of circular logic. Well, we know that there are UFOs because we see them and they do things that you know, normal aircraft can't do. It's like, yeah, but you're already assuming an interpretation of what's being reported. You're assuming the alien spacecraft interpretation when, in fact, we talked about the fact that, you know, eyewitnesses cannot judge distance, speed, and size, especially naked eye against the sky without anything.
You can't even determine a bug in a field on a newscast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so something that's close up, small and slow could be interpreted as far away, huge and fast.
Right. Exactly. That's key. If you know, learn anything from this, if you take that away, that's a huge, huge thing.
Yeah. Just perspective. Yeah. You can't, your mind's eye can be fooled. Your brain will construct the image in a way. It's doing the best it can, but it may not have enough information to really judge size and distance. And so it sort of constructs what it thinks is happening falsely. And
right. And it doesn't matter who you are. There are stories of pilots being confused by this, like a thistle seed floating in the sky that they thought was that exact thing, Steve. Big, fast,
or
and far away.
Balloons,
right.
Whatever.
But it was actually this little thing that was really close, and they never would have known it if it didn't cross in front of a copse of trees. And that's what clued them in. Oh my God, this is close and small. It's not big and far away and fast.
Which gets us to the third big claim here, which is, you know, affidavits from hundreds of upper U.S. and global military sites. That's a bad argument
from authority.
Yep, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. How many times have we heard this one? This goes with the territory like nothing else.
I mean, just because
you're human, you're still human.
They're a scientist doesn't mean that, they're still human doesn't mean that their evidence is good. You still have to look at the quality of the evidence, not just the person who's presenting it. All right, guys, we're going to very quickly, we're going to do a new segment that we're going to try it out this week. And we're still working on the title. You could send in your suggestions, but basically it's the stupidest crap I heard on the internet this week.
This could be a long segment.
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple of contenders actually this week. We kind of missed this one last week. You guys heard about the shopping channel discussion where the two people were arguing about whether or not the moon was a planet or a star.
My brain hurts. Yes.
And they just went on and on. No, the moon is a planet. The other one said, no, the moon is a star. And they clearly had no idea what any of those things were.
God, that still freaks me out. How could you not know what's a moon and what's a star? Like, what do you have to ignore?
Yeah.
Well, they don't care.
Oh, and, God.
At some point, at some level of their existence, they could really give a crap as to what bodies are what.
Yeah, but you could still like those things too, Evan. Not like, how does that get past you?
It's not just It's not priority. Just ignorance and like, oh, they just don't know those obscure facts. These are things that a 5 or 6 year old would pick up. And it's not just that. To me, I can't relate to the lack of curiosity, wanting to know.
Yeah, you have to be profoundly incurious to get to adulthood and not know what the moon is.
I just can't relate to that. People have their own interests.
But these are, Bob, these are things that you see in the sky every day.
Except on the new moon. Or when it's overcast.
I know. It just
makes no sense. I can't wrap my head around that.
You don't have to be an astronomer to know what the moon is. You don't have to have this incredible deep interest to investigate what is the moon exactly. Is it green cheese or a star? What is that? You don't need to be an expert or make a career out of it to just have this idle curiosity, like what's around you.
All right, that was just plain old dumb. But there is something I wanted to talk about for this segment this week. I'm a little bit more serious. There was a recent survey conducted by Oklahoma State University Department of Agricultural Economics. They found that 80% of respondents supported a government policy mandating labels on foods containing DNA.
Oh my God.
Let that sink in for a second. 80% of people think that we need to label all food that contains DNA.
What?
Not GMO, just DNA.
Is that their
there's three letters.
Is that their way around something, Steve? Is that some?
Which is almost the same figure as the number of people who support mandatory labels for GMOs in similar surveys.
Yeah, so you wonder if they really know what the heck they're being asked. And
that's the point. That was the point when someone says DNA.
Yeah. They don't know.
Yeah. Pretty much everything you eat.
It's just a knee-jerk reaction to
plants or animals. It has DNA in it. Yeah.
It's like the food babe.
Stunning.
It's like the food babe. It's just this knee-jerk hatred of, complicated, sciencey sounding things.
Yeah. I mean, it just shows you how worthless those surveys are. People are answering the survey and think, oh, should I be worried about my food containing DNA? It's this thing I don't really understand that sounds scary. Maybe they don't understand that it's already there. It's normal. It's just part of living things.
It's like the dihydrogen monoxide kind of question, even though that one's meant to sort of trap people. I don't think this one was not. But along the same lines, just people don't know. They don't realize what they're being asked.
Apparently. 80%! 4 out of 5 people. Yeah. I mean, that's...
4 out of 5.
That's a lot.
I think that it also could be just another way for them to get the labeling that they want. Make it even more generic.
I don't even know they know the arguments about labeling. Plus, right? They think they've got something in their head that thinks, okay, labels equals good, no matter what you're labeling. More information, therefore, is better. It's sort of this real baseline approach to it. And unless you're going to take a few extra minutes to think about it, you just give out, you give off a yes, I'm for that, or no, I'm not for that. You kind of give off your first thought.
That was very illuminating.
What are we calling this segment?
It's a work of progress. Well, before we go on to science or fiction, we have a few announcements. Jay, Nexus is bearing down on us.
Yeah, this is Nexus 2015, and that's April 9th to 12th in New York City. And if you want more details on how to register and everything, you can go to Nexus, NECSS.org. But I want to talk about our workshops. I don't think we went into any detail previously about it. So we have a lot of awesome workshops. I'll list some of them for you. Viewing Futurism Skeptically by John Rennie. Science Using a Handheld Microscope by Latasha Wright. We have The Art of Communicating Science to the Public by Stephen Hall. Ask a Biologist by Yelena Bernaskaya. And Steve, what's your track?
I'm doing a workshop on advanced critical thinking skills for skeptics.
So this isn't Skepticism 101. This is like 300.
Yeah.
300! Okay, then we have Social Media and Science and Skepticism by Brian Wecht and myself, which I'm really looking forward to. And we have two of those running. And The Science of Taste by Rachel Meyer. Other events that are going on, we have Drinking Skeptically, of course. We have the main conference. On Friday night, we have the SGU Skeptical Extravaganza, which George Hobbs hosts, and that's essentially a series or collections of different bits and routines and presentations that we do, all revolving around science and skepticism. Yeah, it's really funny.
It's a two-hour science comedy extravaganza with a quiz show.
There is no nudity, though, so don't get excited.
Well, I'm not making any promises.
Well, that could work against us, Steve. So please go to nexus.org and ecss.org and take a look at all the different things we have going on.
Also, it's that time of year again, the annual People's Podcast Awards. Nominations are open through February 6th. So if you would like to nominate your favorite podcast, go to podcastawards.com, and then they will publish the nominees, and then you can vote up to once per day for your favorite podcast in each category. So we definitely appreciate the support of our listeners for things like this, because it helps get the word out. And finally, Jay, I have an update on the lawsuit.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, it's good and bad, as my lawyer put it to me. The bad news is that the case is ongoing. It's good. So far, it's looking to go the distance. There's always still a couple of contingencies that could work out in our favor. And it's heading into a very active phase with lots of hearings and such. Active means expensive. Whenever anything happens, it costs a lot of money. So we have been getting great support from our listeners to help us pay, you know, the very expensive legal fees for this. You know, part of the purpose of suing somebody is to just make it as painful for them as possible, right? You're just trying to intimidate them and use thuggery to get that to silence their opinions. In this case, I wrote an article essentially saying that the clinic and the claims being made by one Dr. Tobinick go beyond the evidence, right? He's making claims for efficacy for his treatments that are not adequately supported by evidence. He objected to that opinion, and he's trying to get every time I mention him anywhere, this podcast, you know, every time I mention him, to be taken down because he claims it's defamatory.
Right. But I guess he doesn't understand what science is and how it works.
Well, I don't want to make any assumptions about what he does or does not understand. All I know is what he's doing. Yeah, so, you know, again, we've been able to go this far because of the very, very kind support of our listeners, but, you know, this is a marathon, you know, not a sprint. And we're getting into a very active phase. So we definitely could use your support at this time. Trial is set for September. Those things tend to be fluid, but, you know, if things stay on schedule, we'll probably be in the courtroom in September. If anything, if there are any interesting updates, we'll be giving them to you. Again, there may be things that could happen between now and then that could dramatically change the situation. We'll, of course, let you know if that happens. The good news is, legally, it seems to be going well. In terms of, we definitely, in my opinion, have a solid case, and the other side has nothing. Even when that is the case, it could still cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to demonstrate that in court. You know, so that's the problem that we're facing. Okay, well, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, first theme of the year, four items. The theme is nuts. So how much you guys know about nuts?
Oh, I know.
Oh, cool.
The Ardennes, 1944, the Ardennes Forest, World War II. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I'm good with nuts. All right, I'm ready for this.
You're down with nuts? All right, here we go. Item number one. Raw cashews contain the same highly toxic chemical found in poison ivy, which is in the same family as the cashew tree. Item number two. Walnuts are the number one culinary nut produced worldwide at 23 tons per year. Item number three, botanically speaking, peanuts are legumes, while cashews, pistachios, almonds, and the white part of the coconut that we eat are all seeds. Chestnuts, hazelnuts, and acorns are true nuts. And item number four, the annual pollination event of California almonds requires about 1 million beehives, half of all commercial hives in the U.S. Well, Jay, you seem rather confident.
Bob and I totally delayed.
Say cocky. Why don't you start?
Okay. The raw cashews one and its similarity to poison ivy, it's like the same chemical as poison ivy. I'm going to say that one is science. I'm going to go down to the third one and say that peanuts are legumes are science. Walnuts are the number one culinary nut produced. 23 tons per year. Walnuts. Walnuts over peanuts.
Culinary though.
Yeah. Steve.
Yeah.
If number three is science and peanuts are not legumes, right?
Yeah.
You're not, I hate to say this, but are you counting peanuts in the calculation with number two?
That's why I said culinary nut. So that includes all the things that you'd think of as nuts, whether or not they're nuts or not. Whether or not they're true.
Okay, all right, thank you.
So a culinary nut are things that you think of as nuts, as opposed to botanically. Like, so peanuts are a culinary nut, but they are a botanical legume, is what number three is saying.
Got it. Okay, gotcha. Okay. Okay. And last one, the annual pollination event of California almonds requires about 1 million beehives. Half of all commercial hives in the U.S. Holy shit. That's awesome. That's true. Oh, this is really hard. This is really, really hard. I'm going to say number two is the fiction. The walnuts are the fiction.
Okay. Evan?
The raw cashews, same highly toxic chemical found in poison ivy. Well, raw cashews can definitely make you sick. I think they can kill you. I don't know for sure that it's in the same family as poison ivy. What is the same family as the cashew tree found in poison ivy? If they're related, I've never heard that before, but I know they're both very bad to ingest. So that one's probably true. Walnuts, 23 tons per year. Well, this one's kind of straightforward. Is or isn't. It would have to be kind of a different nut, if not walnuts. So that one's sort of simple. Maybe that one's the fiction. The next one about, oh gosh, you mentioned so many things here, Steve. You could have broken this up into a couple of statements, I think, unto itself. But, peanuts are legumes, cashews, pistachio, almonds, and the white part of coconut are the seeds. Chestnuts, hazelnuts, acorns are nuts. I think that all is right. I obviously don't know all of those, but a few of those I think I've known for a while, so I'll say that one's right. The last one, annual pollination event of California almonds. Oh, that's a big number. 1 million beehives and half of the hives in the U.S. It's either that one or the walnuts. Well, I'll go with Jay. I think it's the walnuts one. I don't know what nut it is if it's not peanuts. It's probably some exotic nut from Asia we've never heard of, but, you know, 3 billion people eat them and we don't eat them here. So I think the walnuts one is fiction.
And Bob.
Oh, man. You really just want my streak to come to a screeching halt, don't you? Yeah, I just know so little about this crap.
You know about peanut butter, Bob?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I just know how to eat it and how good it tastes, but let's see. Yeah, the first one, poison and the cashew. It's related to the cashew tree? Same family? I don't know. That seems a little sketchy. Although I do remember something about the poison and the walnuts, number one culinary nut. I don't know, Jay. I mean, I really don't know how much peanut butter or peanuts are used in a year, but I do know that peanut butter is primarily an American phenomenon. So that might lower what you might think in terms of how, you know, how much peanuts are produced worldwide. So that's making me think that might not be right, but walnuts, the pollination event, a million beehives, half. I mean, all the commercial beekeepers just head over there. I mean, that just seems like a huge thing, but I can kind of see this being true, but I really want to select that one. It just seems so huge. Why do they need so many? I'll go with the group and pick number two, walnuts.
Well, let's start with number one. Raw cashews contain the same highly toxic chemical found in poison ivy, which is in the same family as the cashew tree. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The cashew tree is in the same family as poison ivy, as is the pistachio, also in the same family. That family being Anacardiaceae, or DSA. And the whole family produces, you know, toxic chemicals that are very allergenic, that cause allergies. That's why so many people have like an allergic reaction to poison ivy. It's basically, the chemical is urushiol. Now, some sources said that cashews contain the exact same compound. Others said a closely related compound. Either way, it's the same basic chemical. It may be a slightly different version of it. So the cashew itself doesn't have much of that. It has very little, but still, you wouldn't want to eat a completely raw cashew. Even if you buy something that's called raw cashews, they are always at least steamed, you know, to destroy the allergenic chemicals, you know, with heat. So raw cashews are just not roasted, but they're still heated or steamed something to render the allergens or the toxins inert, so that you wouldn't want to eat them raw. The cashew is actually a very interesting interesting little fruit there. So the cashew creates what's called a cashew apple, which is also not a true fruit, but it is a drupe, and so it's not a you know, in botany, it's not a true fruit, but it looks like a fruit. And it's actually very sweet, and you can eat it. And it's very cool looking. And the cashew hangs from the bottom of the cashew apple. And it's in a shell, and the cashew itself is a seed. And the shell is very toxic. The shell has most of the allergenic chemicals in it. So that's why you'll never see a cashew shell. And in fact, workers who, like, have to pick and shell cashews often will get very sensitive to the chemical and can get sick, and, you know, they may not be able to do it forever because they can have a bad reaction to those chemicals over time. So, yeah, cashews have to be cooked at least a little bit in order for you to be able to eat them. Let's skip over to number three. Botanically speaking, peanuts are legumes, while cashews, pistachios, almonds, and the white part of the coconut that we eat are all seeds. Chestnuts, hazelnuts, and acorns are true nuts. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
So far, so good. Sounds the last two. So, yeah, so, you know, we call lots of things nuts, but a nut, botanically speaking, is a non-dehiscing fruit, which means that, yeah, the fruit doesn't open up at any point. So normally, like in a fruit, the fruit opens up to release the seed so that it can grow another plant. But for nuts, you have a hard shell around a fleshy fruit around a seed, and the whole thing stays together, and that's a true nut. It's like a chestnut is the classic. You guys know what chestnuts look like. Or an acorn. Acorns are also true nuts. Most of the other things that we call nuts are actually seeds. They're the seed of a fruit, you know, and so you have the fruit, a shell, and a seed, and that's it. And the fruit can either be a true fruit or it could be a drupe, which is a type of fruit, I think. Yeah, so cashews, pistachios, almonds, those are all seeds. A lot of the things we think are nuts are seeds. Also, a coconut, same thing. The white part, the fleshy part of the coconut is actually the seed.
That's actually the biggest seed on the planet, isn't it?
I believe so.
Don't try to earn any points, Bob.
Right. Just and peanuts are legumes. They grow under the ground.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to number two. Walnuts are the number one culinary nut produced worldwide at 23 tons per year. You guys all think this one is the fiction. And this one is...
Say it.
The fiction.
Yeah!
Damn.
Oh,
God,
yeah, baby.
Nuts.
Awesome. Thanks for
You guys
the way,
were a little
Jay.
Worried there, weren't you?
A little bit. A little bit. I had a lot going on in my head about number two, the walnut one, but nothing about the bees. I had no info on that one.
Yeah.
A couple
so that was interesting. I got a list here of culinary nuts by type.
By Cracky.
What do you think is the number one?
Is it something we've heard of, or is it some exotic thing?
I think it's peanuts.
Peanuts are number two.
Is it pine nuts?
Actually, walnuts are 2.3 million tons.
2.3 million
Yeah, that
tons.
Sounded low. It says tons. Oh, yeah. So funny. I just assumed you must be right, but yeah, that did seem low.
It's 2,282,264 tons. Yeah, so 2.3 million tons.
So what is it?
Peanuts are 36 million tons at number two. Cashew nuts are 3.3 million tons at number three. Then almonds, then walnuts. What do you think is number one at 61 million tons?
I don't know. The only thing I could think of is pine.
Million?
Maybe pine nuts?
Coconuts. Oh.
Coconuts.
Oh, shit. Yeah, oh, they're so effing heavy.
Because coconuts, peanuts, cashews, almonds, walnuts, chestnuts, then betel nuts, hazelnuts, pistachios, kola nuts, Brazil nuts, and then all other nuts are 830,000 tons.
I love it. Wow, so I was correct. My nut logic is up.
You're so nutty, Jay.
You know
it's so
nothing.
Strange to me to think I have these weird pockets of knowledge.
Yeah. Did I hit I hit another one of your pockets?
You did. I actually know a lot about nuts. I don't know why.
Abraham Lincoln and nuts.
And
well, it's actually Thanksgiving too. Yep.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I forgot about that one.
I mean, don't even F with me about that. I know Thanksgiving upside down and backwards, man.
All right, which means that the annual pollination event of California almonds requires about 1 million beehives, half of all commercial hives in the U.S., and that one is science. That one's, I thought I might get you with that one.
Almost,
so yeah, every
yeah,
February,
very close.
Every February, literally half, about half of the commercial beehives in the U.S. are all shipped to California in the largest annual pollination event in the world.
Awesome.
They release 1 million beehives to pollinate all of the almond trees. Yeah.
Release the bees. Ah! Everyone goes running, now, scattering to the hills.
Steve, I mean, we're talking and they just must fill the air. I mean, it just, I don't know how, yeah. how,
well, they know,
widely separated the trees are, but I mean.
We would be so screwed without bees.
Yeah. In fact, they're trying to create, a self-pollinating almond tree so that would not require the bees. And they have through breeding, not genetic manipulation, through breeding, they've created some self-pollinating almonds. But the almonds they produce are not as big or as efficient. So they're not as productive as the bee pollinated ones.
Well, better than
they
nothing.
Better watch out.
Drop.
Big B might lobby the government and freak out on them.
Yeah.
What we should do is invent a robot that does the same job as bees, and then we don't have to worry about that.
Or robot bees.
Yeah, robot bees.
Yeah, robot bees.
Why don't they just fly those quadcopters like right next to them and blow the pollen all around?
Well, it sticks to the
thank you. I just that, invented an industry.
Jay, that would be good for wind pollinated.
Yeah.
You know,
it has to
plants.
Stick to the bees' legs and stuff. They have to
for bee pollinated, you gotta get in there, you know.
You gotta get in deep, Jay.
Yeah.
Get all the way in there.
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
You're
good
welcome,
job,
guys.
Good job. I think nuts is one of those things. It's like you think you know about nuts, but they're freaking complicated. You know, when
just
you get into
it,
the
just remember
and everything.
Peanuts grow in the ground.
Yeah.
So they're legumes.
Right. Oh, what's coffee then? Coffee is an actual bean? No.
It's a seed. It's not a bean. I was right.
It's
not a
seed of the coffee plant. There you go. That's why.
All right, Evan, hit us up with a quote.
Here we go, guys. To every complex question, there is a simple answer. And it is wrong. Spoken by none other than Henry Louis Mencken himself. H.L. Mencken, American journalist, essayist, magazine editor, satirist, critic of American life and culture, and scholar of American English. His time? He was born in 1880, died in 1956, and skeptical audience might recognize him for his satirical reporting he did on the Scopes trial, which he dubbed the Scopes Monkey Trial. So if you know it by the by the name Scopes Monkey Trial, you can thank H.L. Mencken.
Now, Evan, I've always heard a different version of that quote, and I looked it up, and this is the one that comes up. For every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong, which sounds a little bit more punchy than the version that you read. I'm not sure what source you used for that. Maybe he said it more than once in different ways, but that's... I mean, it's interesting that you have, that somebody had the quote different.
It happens all the time.
Any quote has it as one. Yeah. Wiki quote has it as something else. Among the places it appears are our friends over at brainyquote.com.
Yeah. I'm just curious. Is that, are people paraphrasing differently or did he say it differently at different times?
You know, perhaps. I mean, we've come across this before in which, you know, words have kind of evolved, shall we say, to put it nicely. Over the decades or centuries, depending on the quote.
So what happens often is that people say a sentiment, but they don't quite nail it in terms of its punchiness. And then later on in recounting what they said, they clean it up, you know, they make it more concise or witty or whatever.
Sure.
But the original version wasn't quite perfect. But Mencken is a writer. You know what I mean? I would think he would have had the polished version in whatever he was writing, wherever the quote was coming from.
Oh, and did you know, H.L. Mencken, about H.L. Mencken, that in 1931, the Arkansas legislature passed a motion to pray for Mencken's soul after he called the state the apex of morania.
He didn't mince his words.
No, he did not pull punches, as they say.
All right, well, guys... Next time we get together, it'll be 500!
500!
Unbelievable that we're at already. Well, guys, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Steve.
I learned a lot this week.
And until next week, This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.